Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tempus Fury by Dana Fredsty and David Fitzgerald. Narrated by Aaron Shedlock. 1. Exaltationist, Gestaltist disputed territory. Outside the village of Horvath, Borsha de Boisemplain Republic. Formerly, northeastern Hungary. July 18th, 2216. 3 years before the event. There had been 12 soldiers in the squad 3 days ago. Now there were 7. In good formation, they cautiously made their way up the footpath between meadows and vineyards, toward the village. Here and there locals tended the vineyards, showing little interest in the newcomers. A cursory scan revealed no hostility. The mountainous landscape was green and lush, as if unchanged for centuries. Aside from a trio of boxy robot shepherds tending a flock of sheep. Sergeant Mavanoy Cochran breathed in the crisp, fresh air, admiring the view, trying hard not to think of all the burnt-out cityscapes she had marched through over the years. In places like this, however, the forgotten nooks and crannies of the world, she could almost believe they had found an oasis from the decades of endless world war. A deserter's dream, she thought, careful to mask it from her subordinates.
Sarge, we have contact.
An incoming thought from Peters, their point man, interrupted her reverie. At the top of the rise, where an ancient tavern stood and the cobblestone streets of the hamlet began, a quartet of village elders awaited their arrival. Cochran halted the squad and signaled Peters to hold up. She turned to her comms specialist, Silva, who was also her best diplomat.
Silva, go talk to them, she sent.
Bradley, go with them.
The two soldiers cradled their carbines, attempting a less confrontational manner and approach the elders. Bradley, one of the squad's 2 sweepers, was a talented esper. He'd already be telepathically scanning the 4 villagers.
Yuri Gert, Kivanok,
Silva greeted them with a friendly wave. He spoke very little of the local dialect, but had made a point of learning a few basic pleasantries. It was polite to speak aloud before initiating a telepathic conversation with a stranger. After a few minutes, Silva and Bradley shook hands with the locals, and the comms specialist stepped away, waving down to the squad.
"What's the story, Silva?"
Cochran asked.
"Outstanding," Silva replied. "We have good, better, and best news, Sarge. This place is called Horvath, and they say they're unaffiliated with any factions. We and any other Gestaltist troops are welcome to stay here as their guests. They also told us the Exaltationist main force left here 2 days ago, headed over the border, to which they say, good riddance."
She nodded in approval. In this case, the border meant the border with the Matra Slanik Federation, formerly a chunk of southern Slovakia. For the last 150 years, Europe, like the rest of the world, had dissolved from nation-states into a patchwork of petty fiefdoms. No, Cochran corrected herself. Patchwork was the wrong word. That would imply there were still large centralized territories left. The world was now a mosaic of tiny local authorities. Various psionic factions had taken up the mantle of governing, or at least raising armies. Not surprising that the locals didn't take to the Exaltationists. That faction was one of the most notorious of the Psi premisists. To them, the non-psychic minority weren't just second-class citizens. They were outright chattel. Evolutionary has-beens, no better than animals. The only factions that treated the non-psionic worse were the Vorax, psychic vampires that happily fed on them, and the Ouroboros, the psionic hive mind spreading across Asia like a pandemic. Their Gestaltist precogs had warned that the Ouroboros sought to absorb the mind and personality of every person on Earth. These people in Horvath didn't know how lucky they were.
Sarge.
She glanced at her second sweeper specialist. He was staring intently down at the villagers tending to the vineyards on the hillside below.
What is it, Dee?
He turned to her, fear in his eyes.
Sarge, I scanned again for hostility, deeper, just in case, and I'm not reading anything. They've been hollowed.
The field hands had been brain-wiped. Cochran whirled and sent to the entire squad.
Ambush! Shields up!
Not a millisecond too soon. Automatic weapon fire erupted from the upper windows of the tavern and the closest buildings. The spray of bullets ricocheted off their telekinetic shields, illuminating them with a ghostly glare. Silva and Bradley turned to take cover, but the 4 villagers, or whatever they were, dropped their psychic masks and went on the attack. Both soldiers stiffened, faces locked in a rictus, and then crumpled. Hitting the ground, the squad opened up with their spindle-fed TK assault carbines, but the ambushers had raised their telekinetic shields. Peters, still on point, low-crawled closer to the outlying buildings, but didn't bother trying to blast through their shields. A highly rated pyrokinetic, he just focused his attention on first one roof, then the other, igniting a blaze on both. The rest of the squad focused their fire on the quartet, but their shields held, disc shapes glowing bright with every impact. The four turned to face them. Suddenly, Peters grabbed his head and writhed in pain, dropping and curling into a fetal position. Then Cochrane was hit. The sun exploded, ripping the skin of the shrieking sky apart in a violent, pulsating nightmare. Monstrous, disembodied human eyeballs bubbled up through the leprous ground and began devouring Kwame, their heavy gunner. His screams echoed and reverberated infinitely in her ears, while his body went twisting and stretching into impossible shapes until his torso burst open. Torn inside out like a pulpy fruit, mangled by a raging lunatic god. Cochrane fought to regain control of her hijacked senses, but the sensory onslaught was overpowering. The sky plunged into a crushing, hopeless black night. Abandoned by stars, the haunted moon, a howling death's head staring down on the ring of grinning corpses surrounding her, their faces melting into grave rot. They reach for her, stretching forth horrid, grasping, hungry, cadaverous clawed hands, covetous of her naked warmth. Her resistance slipped as the telepaths reached down into the amygdala region of her brain, triggering the emotional center. Forcing herself to remain calm, she tried to concentrate on the location of her four opponents, even as she felt them twisting the knife in her mind. A cyclone of a million fractaling razor blades flailing through banshee winds, ripping through her flesh, face, stomach, fingers, everywhere merciless and unstoppable, slicing her body in a universe of pure pain, 10,000 bloody wounds made of her. Cochrane screamed in agony. She struggled to stay alive long enough to pour all her mindfulness into one last telekinetic burst. If only she could... She was falling. She was on fire. She was a newborn baby being eaten alive by her own mother. A sudden, violent wrenching. The ground gave a single, quick, booming jolt, and then the pain vanished. So did the flashing hellscapes. The sergeant found herself on her knees, fingers dug deep into the turf, limbs shaking, body covered in sweat. She looked at the enemy. Her telekinetic attack had succeeded. She had reached around their line of protective shields and pulled apart the wall of the burning tavern. It had smashed them like a giant fly swatter. Behind the smoldering slab, the two closest buildings were engulfed in flames. Inside them, shooters screamed as the fire took them. Then the sound stopped. No other hostiles in sight. It was a quiet day in the beautiful countryside again, save for the crackling of burning wood and the heavy breathing of her soldiers. Myers, their squad medic, ran up. Cochrane waved her away.
I'm fine, she said in her crisp British accent. Check Peters and Kwame.
She turned to Dee. He was kneeling on the grass, his face slick with tears. The barrel of his pistol was in his mouth.
Dee?
She called to him. After a few heartbeats, he slowly pulled the gun away.
How long?
He croaked.
Dee, are you okay?
He stared blankly.
How many years was I gone?
Fight's all over. Only lasted a few seconds.
He shook his head.
No, it was decades. I grew old and feeble in there.
Myers went over to the Esper and crouched beside him, touching her fingers to his temple, talking to him gently while she mentally ran diagnostics. After a minute or two, she returned to Cochrane.
He'll be all right. It'll just take a little time to shake off the effects. How are the others? Silver and Bradley are dead. Hostiles crushed their hearts before they could get their blocks up. Peters is shaken, but I think he'll be okay.
She looked over at Kwame, their heavy gunner. He was standing stock still, his spindle-fed cannon dangling from its straps, and his blank eyes rolled back. Turning back to the sergeant, she shook her head.
Kwame's left the building. I can put some suggestions into his lizard brain to keep him marching with us, but he's hollowed.
Myers handed over 3 dog tags. Sergeant Cochran nodded. Walking, killed in action.
All right.
She sent out to what remained of her squad.
We still have 3 clicks to go to get to the bunker. Quick sweep up top to secure the area, and then we're on the move again. D, you back with us?
He wiped his face with the back of his hand, nodded.
Good. You're on double duty now, comms and sweeper. Stay sharp, everyone.
The squad survivors moved out. Below, the villagers continued tending to the vines, industrious as bees, oblivious to the world. When they finally reached the hatch of the spindle bunker, Cochran breathed a silent prayer of thanks to the Corps of Engineers. It was right where the map indicated it would be, freshly planted and camouflaged. Bending down, she uncovered the square slab of nano-woven ferro-concrete and mentally asked Dee for the combination.
Cerulean, lemniscate, anti-clockwise, he responded.
Cochran pictured a deep blue infinity symbol and set it gently in motion, spinning right over left as it hovered above the hatch.
Zinnober, triangle, inverted.
She set the image of an upside-down chrome-green triangle next to the little spinning blue propeller.
Topaz, pentagon, clockwise.
Last, she added a yellowish-brown gem-toned pentagon, spinning opposite to the infinity sign. She held all 3 shapes in her mind's eye. The hatch made a sharp clack, unlocked, and began to sink. It descended 15 centimeters before halting with a second clack, and slid away into a recess, revealing a narrow stone ramp. A line of tiny blue fluorescent lights, like helpful fireflies, showed the way. The remnants of the squad trudged down, exhausted and grateful. At the bottom of the ramp lay the recharge chamber, dominated by the bunker's spindle, its psionic power generator, hovering silently in the air between floor and ceiling. It was a black, elongated diamond structure with a hexagonal cross-section about 60 centimeters wide in the middle, tapering to a tiny, flat hexagon at either end. As the spindle sensed their approach, it activated with an almost imperceptible hum, slowly beginning to spin and flickering to life. Pale traces of lightning began to dance in its smoky crystalline interior, growing to an incandescence that suffused the entire generator with light. The squad's assault carbines and powered equipment operated on psionic batteries as well. Each soldier unclipped their weapon's smaller spindles and spares, placing them close to the mother spindle. They hung in the air like crystal ornaments, orbiting the generator as they recharged. Activating the spindle's communications array, Cochran spoke aloud.
Sergeant Mavanoy Cochran, 138th Kinetic Infantry, Lima 1109.
While she reported in, the rest inflated their cots and dug into their rations. At Myers' instruction, Kwame sat, back to the wall, remaining motionless.
D, you've got mail, Cochran said.
After a moment, she added quietly,
It's from a precog.
The whole team looked up at that. Forkfuls of food halted midway to their mouths. Mail was rare enough. Private channel messages sent from HQ to a grunt were unheard of. A private message from military intelligence? Unimaginable.
Probably just foreseeing a Dear John letter,
Peters cracked.
Or maybe they forecasted you buying the farm?
Myers kicked him and shot him a reproachful glare.
Sorry, D,
he mumbled. The sweeper swallowed, then got up and cautiously approached the spindle array, wiping his hands on his fatigues.
Specialist John DeMetta, 138th Kinetic Infantry, Delta 1226.
The rest of the squad waited in hushed silence while he telepathically received his message. When he finally turned around and walked back to his cot, he said nothing. Peters and Myers exchanged worried glances.
Well, what is it already?
Peters burst out.
Caught the chatter, Peters,
the sergeant snapped.
The message is for him, nobody else. Got it?
It's okay, Sarge, DeMetta said. It's not classified. Honestly, I don't know what the hell to make of it.
He frowned and shook his head.
It didn't make any sense. Just something about a girl. Amber.
No one said anything.
Dear John,
Peter sent to Myers. She nodded.
2. Richardson Home, San Diego, California.
Amber woke up. She lay with her eyes closed for a few minutes, trying to capture her dreams, but finding the images frustratingly vague, like a mental itch she couldn't scratch. Broken snippets tickled her brain. Swirls of pyramids, roundhead and French Napoleonic soldiers, dinosaurs, and talking flying bowling balls, and a man with violet eyes, stars streaming through their depths. At first, it all seemed so real. Then, in the way of dreams, it made no damn sense. The image of a man suddenly crystallized, early 20s with strong features and a scar on his cheek, dark shaggy hair falling to broad shoulders, a silver torque around his throat.
Cam,
she thought. Yes, that seemed right. Once his name and face solidified in her mind, so did others who had populated her dream. Nellie, a young Victorian woman with auburn hair and clever green eyes. Harcourt, another Victorian but older and somehow irritating. Blake, a World War II British soldier who'd saved her life more than once. As quickly as the images came, they blurred again and faded. Try as she might, she couldn't hold on to them.
Darn it!
She tried one more time to grasp the memory, then shrugged and realized what she really needed.
Coffee.
With a yawn, she stretched out on her bed, reveling in the crisp, clean linen sheets, then looked around her bedroom. A menagerie of well-loved stuffed animals on the shelf, the picture window looking out on Mission Bay, the cast of Firefly looking back at her from the poster on her wall, promising her that they aimed to misbehave. From downstairs, the muffled sound of canned laughter came from the TV. She could smell waffles and bacon, and her stomach growled. Slipping an oversized Padres jersey on over her underwear, she wandered barefoot down the shag-carpeted stairs to grab some breakfast. At the bottom, she paused for a moment to stare at a tall, stately grandfather clock standing against the far wall in the entryway.
Huh. That's new. Mom? Dad?
She called out as she wandered into the dining room.
Hey, when do we get a grandfather
Amber stopped in her tracks. Neither her parents nor sister and brother were there, but two more grandfather clocks stood upright at either end of the table.
Okay, that's weird.
Her voice echoed in the empty room. Fighting a rising sense of unease, she backed away and went into the family room, following the comforting sound of the TV. Another grandfather clock stood there like a monolith, parked in front of the television set, the dancing black and white static reflecting off its glassy face. It made no sense. Amber's heart started racing. She went back to the entryway and approached the front door.
Nothing scary there,
she thought, even as her heart galloped in her chest.
Just a door.
As she reached for the door handle, it seemed to recede, the air thickening around her hand like warm gelatin. Clenching her jaw, she pushed through, grabbed the handle and shoved the door open, stepping out onto the porch. There was no one in sight. Across the street, a grandfather clock stood on the porch, facing her. Two more were on the sidewalk in front of the house, side by side, as if caught in mid-stroll. Another was down at the corner, and yet another in the middle of the front yard next door. Three more stood sentry at random spots along the street and sidewalks. A low, rumbling noise came from down the block, like the sound of garbage bins being rolled out. The street a few houses down rippled like an oasis in the desert heat. Amber watched as the ripple turned into a long, sinuous shape rising out of the asphalt, a huge crocodile swimming through the street as though it were water. It drew abreast to her house, then submerged, vanishing from sight. Heart hammering in her chest, she retreated back into the house, bolting upstairs. At the top, she threw open a door before registering that there wasn't supposed to be one there. On the other side, instead of the hallway, there was a small room, featureless and unfurnished. Another door in the opposite wall. Running to the door, she flung it open. Another equally sterile room, another unwelcoming door. In full panic mode, she turned back to the first door, but instead of leading to the stairs, it opened to yet another small room with yet another door in the far wall. Fear mixing with anger, she screamed and ran for that door. It opened to a small room with a door. She opened it to find another door. And another door, and another. Time and again she burst through, great shuddering breaths pumping through her lungs, turning to sobs as she twisted knob after knob. and then, when her terror seemed too much to bear, she opened yet another door and rushed inside, into pitch darkness. 3. Evacuation Zone. Somewhere in the ruins of the Khan el-Khalili Souk el-Kahira Governorate, formerly Cairo, Egypt. February 2, 2219. 25 minutes before the event. Even when the ancient city had been alive and full of people, its alleys and souks had formed a confusing warren. In the moonlight, the ruins of the lost Cairo megapolis were a surreal and disturbing labyrinth, yawning holes and twisted chunks of concrete or metal or stone that stood like abstract statues of lost souls. For the pair of soldiers nursing the wheezing, cantankerous hovercraft through the maze, over broken streets littered with dust, ash, and tangles of bones and skulls, it was a waking nightmare. The vehicle kicked up great plumes of dust, the twin headlight beams barely piercing the haze in front of them. Both soldiers kept their eyes peeled for trouble, alert for whatever might be lurking in the twists and turns of the haunted streets. Sergeant Cochrane gritted her teeth, her grip so tight on the jumpy, uncooperative stick of their commandeered vehicle that her fingers cramped.
"How much further to the extraction, Demeter?"
"We're close, less than a click," he answered.
"And how close are the Ouroboros?"
"Still advancing through Central City. Everything west of Gezira Island is overrun, and they've reached Tahrir Square. To the north, the main body has just crossed Ramses Street, and there's a division coming down Salah Salim to do a pincer action from the east."
"Just great," Cochrane thought darkly. "Can we still get out through the south?
If they don't encircle the whole city first.
How soon before we're in range of their Medusa?"
"At the rate they're closing in, I'm guessing 20 minutes, if we're lucky. If they fail to elude the dragnet closing in on them, the approaching Ouroboros vanguard would crack their psyches like eggs and absorb them into the hive mind, just as it had done to more than 2/3 of the human population of Earth. It had taken less than 16 months. Cochrane increased the hovercraft speed as much as she dared. They turned a corner, and the maze around them exploded into light. They caught a fleeting glimpse of a dazzlingly bright, vaguely human shape as a deafening psychic banshee scream tore through them, overloading their senses with raw bursts of pure insanity.
"Berserker!"
That was all Cochrane managed to get out before the lightning storm raged through her neural pathways into the core of her brain. Her body's muscles locked up, causing her to simultaneously slam on the braking thrusters and rev the accelerators. With a queasy lurch, the hovercraft flew into a spin, careening out of control. They hurtled forward, slamming directly toward the shrieking inferno of glaring light. Something struck them with a sickening crunch and another explosive burst of intense brightness. An instant later, they clipped a section of wall and rebounded before finally coming to a juddering halt.
"We're not dead,"
Demeter said aloud, sounding surprised.
"As if we'd be that lucky,"
Cochrane replied, rubbing her neck.
"What happened to the scream job?"
Demeter looked behind them. A pair of blood trails led to where the former human had been torn in two. For a change, their shit luck had a silver lining. The hovercraft had crashed into and killed the thing that sent them out of control in the first place. Bad things happen when psychics overloaded and blew out their psionic power. In most cases, they died horribly. Brains turned into gray mush. In the case of berserkers, though, the manifestation of self-destruction was more spectacular. Berserkers were what remained of a flame-out case whose brainstem remained just intact enough to become ID-driven, walking psionic Chernobyls. Some psionically annihilated any mind they encountered. Others demolished everything in their path with frenzied telekinetic blasts. It no longer mattered what faction they'd served. They were, to all extents and purposes, the psychic undead.
"Berserker contact resolved?"
Demeter deadpanned. Cochrane nodded.
"I'll take it."
She turned her attention back to the controls.
"Let's move."
Their hovercraft's turbines caterwauled more than before as Cochrane urged it back to life. Its battered skirt panels rattled as they sped through the maze of rubble. Crossing the wide thoroughfare of Nafaq al-Azhar into a sector of lesser devastation, they pulled up at their contact point, the domed remains of a grand Ottoman mosque. The ancient wooden front doors were scorched, but still finely engraved with tessellated geometric designs. Cochrane stood by, covering Demeter with her assault carbine while he beat on the door 3 times, then twice, then 3 times again, and finally sent the password to anyone within 10 meters.
Konda.
Kerpan,
came the countersign a moment later. They pushed open the great doors and entered the sacred space. Chains of unlit brass lanterns hung suspended from the domed ceiling overhead. It was richly tiled with arabesques and ringed with calligraphic verses from the Quran. Below that were rows of broken stained glass windows, some tall and long, others forming clusters of little portholes. Stray pale beams of moonlight lanced down through them, illuminating a smooth stone floor littered with fresh corpses. A tremendous firefight had occurred here. There were a few dead transcendentist troopers in urban camo fatigues and spiked turbans, but the majority of the casualties were wearing civilian clothes, working smocks, face masks, aprons. Judging from the stacks of crates, overturned tables, and a scattering of spindles, tools, and material, the mosque had been converted into a guerrilla weapons factory.
Over here,
a Japanese-accented voice called out. A pair of transcendentist soldiers, one Asian, the other Slavic, their impressive beards and mustaches fastidiously groomed, had taken position behind the ablutions fountain. They rose from their cover and saluted the new arrivals with great formality.
Prefect Lance Corporal Anzai and Initiate Svoboda, unified true transcendent forces at your service.
Demeter thought of how Peters would refer to them as transcendentists. He carefully concealed that memory. The transcendentists were notoriously humorless. It was strange to be allied after generations of warring with them, but even quasi-religious, deeply controlling cultists were better than a voracious hive mind.
Sergeant Cochrane and Esper Specialist Demeter, Cochrane said brusquely, all business. What happened here? Rogue faction?
Anzai shook his head.
Unaffiliated. Criminals, in fact. Our intel tipped us off to an underground bomb-making operation here in the ruins.
So close to the Hive Advance? That's suicidal.
She shook her head.
Never mind. We don't have time for this. We were told there were 3 of you. Where's your prisoner?
Anzai turned and pointed behind him. Nearby lay a sealed metal capsule roughly the size of a sofa. A small bank of system monitors and controls was on one side, instructions and notations all in Cyrillic. It took Cochrane a moment to recognize what it was. A hibernation pod, just like long-range astronauts used in the old days, back when nation-states had space programs. She shot a glance at Demeter.
Do you buy any of this shit?
Hell no. And we sure as hell don't have time to figure out what their game is, either.
She turned back to the transcendentists, eyebrow raised.
Your prisoner isn't there?
Yes, ma'am. In suspended animation.
Well, open it up and get him out. Let's go.
Ma'am, we can't open the capsule.
Anzai's previously unruffled composure cracked.
Then he's a no-go, she replied. We're out of here, now.
Her gaze was steely.
Surely we can lift it together between the 4 of us.
Look, Corporal, I don't know your TK ratings, but even if we can lift it to the street, there's no way in hell we'll be able to fit it on the hovercraft. Either crack it open now, or he's staying here.
We cannot leave this in the hands of the Ouroboros,
the Corporal responded flatly. Cochrane cocked her head slightly and stared at the man through narrowed eyes.
Okay, just what the hell do you people have here?
We have to get it out of the city,
Svoboda insisted.
What the fuck do you people have here?
Cochrane shouted. Taking a deep breath, Anzai replied.
We strongly suspect it is a precog.
The 2 Gestaltist troopers stared at him.
A rogue precog?
Precisely, ma'am.
Cochrane and Demeter looked at each other. Precognitive operatives were among the rarest and potentially most powerful psionic talents. Letting one fall under Ouroboros control would be an irreparable strategic disaster. The ability to forecast the future was the only advantage the Alliance had left over the hive mind. She put a hand on Demeter's shoulder.
Demeter, I need you to see what's really inside there, and do it fast.
Demeta nodded. Unslinging his carbine, he carefully set it on the stone floor and knelt by the capsule.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?